listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby. You're listening to Cutting the Curd, hosted by Ann Saxelby, broadcast live to the cosmos on the Heritage Radio Network.
Welcome to another episode of Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. Our show is being produced and engineered today by Jack Inslee and generously sponsored by 360 Degree Cookware. 360 Cookware is top-of-the-line stainless steel cookware that is made in America in the greenest cookware manufacturing facility in the country. It can be used to make all your favorite recipes, but also gives the option to cook using vapor technology, which creates a seal that surrounds food with intense heat, locking in vitamins, moisture, and flavor without added oil, fat, or excess water. Visit our website at 360cookware.com for more information. So today I am very pleased to have on the show Michael Anderson, who is an expert in the realm of affinage, a sort of a nebulous and mysterious subject to most, I feel like most people out there. Thanks for being on the show, Mike.
Appreciate Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Thank you. So you've spent the last couple of years working as the cave manager at Murray's Cheese.
I did, yes.
And how did you, you know, one does not go to school to become an affineur unless you live in France, maybe. So how did you make that leap?
Well, it just kind of snowballed into it, basically. You don't go to school for cheese aging in this country yet, at least.
Yet. Hopefully at some
give
point.
Give us a decade or two.
Yeah.
I dropped out of music school several years back and was, you know, working jobs at various places, trying to find something that fit, and wound up at a pretty good gourmet store in my hometown in central Illinois that had a pretty decent cheese counter. So just got more and more into that as time went by, and wound up moving out to New York to work on the counter at Murray's. Worked there for about 3.5 years, assistant manager store for a little while. My predecessor, Zoe Brickley, was working in the caves at Murray's, and she left to move up to the cellars at Jasper Hill. So as soon as that position opened up, I jumped on it because that's really kind of where my interests lie, is with the taking care of the products. Not as much of the customer service, but
I understand that.
Yeah, yeah. The cheeses and the people who make them is what was most interesting to me, and that's a really great opportunity to do a lot of that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so when Zoe left, what was your expectation of what affinage would entail? And did it sort of, what were the things that surprised you, I guess, about your new job?
Well, I mean, it's kind of continuous surprises. Every week is something new, but I don't know. It's a really interesting side of the process to see, because if you go to farms and see cheese makers, you'll see like a little bit of that. You'll see like the half dozen cheeses that they make kind of aging through their lives. And if you go to a cheese store, you see the finished product in the case there. But kind of between point A and point B, there's kind of a lot that can go right and a lot can go wrong. And that's something a lot of people don't think about is what can go wrong between the cheesemaker and the cheese store.
Absolutely. Well, so I was thinking, yeah, what are your most important principles for aging cheeses properly and caring for them?
Yeah, well, basically, unless you have a pretty sophisticated setup, you just want to minimize the amount of time that you're keeping cheese in refrigeration. You just want to sell it as soon as possible, basically. It's the best thing you can do.
Right.
But it really depends on the style of cheese. I mean, that's especially true for like a fresh cheese. But something like at the other end of the spectrum, like a Parmesan, there's almost nothing you can do to that cheese to mess it up once it gets to this country. You mm-hmm. can keep it at 60 degrees. You can keep it at 32 degrees. You can keep it at any humidity level, and basically nothing's going to go wrong with that cheese. And then everything in between.
And what kind of... How many cheeses were you in charge of, and what were the different setups that you used to, you know, what were the caves like? How did you have them set up to sort of deal with these different kinds of cheese?
Yeah, well, it got up to about I think over 300 different kinds of cheese.
Wow.
At one point. Yeah, from a lot of different places.
Where would the cheeses come in from?
Well, I mean, we're working in like European cheese tradition. So like Western Europe and North America is mm-hmm. where 99% of the cheese we had was coming from. France, United States, Italy, England, Switzerland are the big ones. Mm-hmm. Spain. But yeah, we have over at Murray's, we had half a dozen different spaces, different temperatures and humidity levels for all different styles of cheese. And it kind of runs in a narrow range. We're talking like between 45 degrees and 55 degrees
mm-hmm.
Fahrenheit, and between about 85% and 95% humidity. So it's kind of a narrow band, but a lot can change in there, and depends on the different styles, what you're going to keep where.
Right. And so, well, it's interesting because, you know, we were just talking, I remember the other day we mentioned that some people think that affinage, the art of aging cheese, automatically makes a cheese better. And there are some cheeses that will become better with careful, you know, attention and good affinage. And some cheeses which are just kind of made to, you know, be eaten at a certain stage and that's it. So can you tell us about some of the cheeses that sort of you feel like benefited the most from?
Yeah, well, the way I always kind of describe it is that every cheese has kind of a bell curve of quality. Like time is on the bottom there and quality is on the side of your graph. And as you go through time, the cheese will improve and get better, and it reaches a point where it's at its best. And then over time, it kind of falls off and gets worse. But depending on what cheese you're talking about, that window gets, you know, wider or narrower. With mozzarella, it's like a very short window. Mm-hmm. You're talking like a
fresh cheese.
A very fresh cheese in a matter of days for that. But then something like a cloth-bound cheddar, you can age for, you know, 12, 18, 24 months. Mm-hmm. And it really starts to shine right about there. But then there is a point of diminishing returns where that does kind of fall off.
And what were some of the cheeses that you feel like you, like the styles of cheese that you were able to influence the most during, you know, because there are certain cheeses, like you said, like a Parmesan that you can just leave in there forever and it's not really going to change that much. What was your experience with cheeses that you were able to change in a shorter period of time?
Well, the big one is like soft, bloomy rinded cheeses because those rinds are so delicate. They need a lot of care. And those are the ones we see the most problems with between the cheesemaker and the cheese store.
Right.
It's an easy style to get into for a cheesemaker. It's a relatively forgiving sort of rind to grow, but once it's grown, a lot can go wrong with it, and then it falls off a lot quicker if it gets damaged in transit. So that's one that is very beneficial to be able to age, you know, from fresh to maturity. Like put the rind on it at the store, basically.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great thing that we were able to do.
And what kind of techniques would you use to sort of make sure that those rinds stayed, you know, sort of in their best condition?
Well, letting them breathe is very important. If any of those mold rinds kind of stay wrapped up and stagnate, they're only going to suffer over time. The rinds are going to die and get, you know, slick and fall off the cheese. So letting them breathe was definitely important.
And when you say letting them breathe, what kind of things would you do? You would obviously unwrap them.
Yeah, well, we were set up over at Murray's to keep cheese open to the air,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of a big disconnect from a lot of other ways you'd be able to store cheese. Like wrapped up in a refrigerator is kind of the alternative to that. And once you have it open to the air, then that kind of opens up a whole nother direction to, you know, to take things in, because you have to watch the temperature, you have to watch the humidity, you have to watch the air exchange. A lot more things you have to be concerned about when you're actually kind of nurturing the growth of these cheeses, as opposed to like keeping them as cold as possible, keeping them as arrested as possible. So that's kind of the difference between like refrigeration and aging, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I feel like, you know, it's interesting. This is a really sort of, I feel, a difficult thing for a lot of retailers. And I've heard it from cheesemakers and from other retailers as well, that, you know, it is hard to manage these types of cheeses. So I feel like this show could almost be a little like 101 for retailers, like how to take care of your bloomy rind cheeses. You know, if we could just even talk for 5 minutes about that, I feel like.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even something like, instead of, you know, putting plastic wrap right on the rind of a cheese, maybe put it into a box. And if the box is wrapped and you wrap the box in plastic, maybe, you know, poke some holes in it to even allow some gases to exchange that could benefit the
creating
cheese.
Creating a little terrarium.
Yeah,
like, sort of.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the word I was looking for.
Yeah. And when you say box, do you mean a wooden box, cardboard box?
Wooden box. Cardboard is kind of disgusting.
Cardboard seems like you might get soggy.
Yeah, cardboard, it might get soggy, and you don't know where it's been a lot of the times. You want to use something clean to keep these things in.
Right.
And even something as simple as like turning a cheese over, if it's going to be sitting in a walk-in for more than a few days, just flip it over onto its other side, because you'll see things like kind of come out of the structure of the cheese, and you get like a soggy bottom, basically. Mm-hmm. And even just flipping it over once a week makes a big difference for something like that. Just thinking of something like Humboldt fog, even.
Yeah. Which you see in various stages of ripeness and or overripeness, in retail stores throughout the country. So
absolutely.
Yeah, it's like you said, you start out with the same product, and then you it's your job to nurture it from the time it leaves the cheesemaker to the time it gets to the customer.
Right. Yeah, and it's an important thing. A lot can go wrong there, but a lot can go right there. So it's just something to pay attention to, I think.
Yeah. What other advice would you have for retailers in terms of how they receive and care for their cheese once they have it in their stores?
Well, you definitely want to keep an eye on how the quality is as soon as it gets to you, because you want to know if something's gone wrong before you've gotten your hands on it.
Absolutely.
That's a big point, because if it's not your fault, you don't want to have to eat the cost of that. I will just say that you want to kind of know what bad cheese is. You're gonna have to know when a cheese has gone bad, and it's gonna be a matter of tasting a lot of cheese and a lot of different stages of quality.
And how forgiving are you, in terms of when a cheese comes in, if it's been a little beat up in shipping? Like, it could be that, the cheese left the cheesemaker and it wasn't bad cheese, and then it suffered a little bit, but, where do you sort of draw the line with cheese that, you receive that might not be in the best shape?
Well, it's honestly rare that we get something that is unsaleable, I would say. Like, almost everything that is coming in is usable, but when you want to use it is important. If there are things that aren't going to last quite as long, and you even though that you've received them later, you might want to use them a little bit sooner. Like if you have the bloomy rinds, if the rind is slipping off of a bloomy rind, it's not going to last much longer. The rind is just going to detach a little bit more, get thicker and chewier, and cheese isn't going to ripen anymore. So you want to sell that as fast as possible. Whereas if you've got something that might be a little bit older, but your rind's a little bit tighter on there, that'll hold up for another week, and you can keep that. But it's just a matter of keeping an eye on it and knowing what to do with these things.
Yeah, it's funny. I feel the same as you. Like, I feel like very few cheeses are actually unsaleable,
right.
And so you just kind of have to gauge and make the best of it.
Right.
Yeah. And then in terms of like unwrapping, rewrapping, do you sort of think that once cheeses come in, the retailer should unwrap them, inspect them, and rewrap them or should they just kind of...
I mean, I definitely think so. If you're able to do that makes a big difference, because number one, it lets the cheese breathe. Is if you're unwrapping it, then anything that's in there isn't stagnating and getting weird. And number two, if you're leaving a wheel of cheese wrapped up in plastic for a long time, like a number of days or a couple of weeks, those plasticky flavors are going to seep into the cheese to some extent, which you don't necessarily want. So replacing that periodically is always a good idea. And even using like wax paper to keep the plastic directly or off the direct surface of the cheese is not a bad idea either.
Cool. Both for whole wheels and for cut pieces?
Yeah, whole wheels and cut pieces. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, one thing you don't really want to do is leave a whole wheel of a cheese unwrapped in a cold storage space, because it's just going to dry out and crack and go wrong in the other direction.
Right. Absolutely. Well, it looks like it's about time for us to take a break, but when we come back, we're going to talk more about what's going on with affinage in the rest of the country, and stick with us on Cutting the Curd.
One, two, one, two, keep it on. Listen to the shit because we keep it till dawn. Listen to the ass track, got it going on. Listen to the ladies, come on and let me spawn. Pour your eggs, then you go up the river. Listen to the ass track, that freaky nigga.
Now I'm that rock and I shock and I tick and I talk and I can't stop with the body rock. See, I got heart like John Stoss. The hit bounce boss. Pass me the mic and I'll be rocking the whole park.
From the M to the C to the A and it's a boss. The rhymes that we boss on the topic of lust. And my mind's just not butt, but fuck it, let me get down to the rhythm. Yes, I get funky and I'm shooting on my tism like John Boom, the X-rated nigga. Listen to the shit, cause I am the ill figure. Nobody's getting any bigger than this.
Get it together.
Phone is ringing. Oh my God.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Monday at 2 p.m., Snacky Tunes hosts some of today's most cutting-edge musicians and DJs. And while the requisite live radio fare is usually presented as a song here, a DJ set there, hosts Finger on the Pulse also talk food, sustainability, and green issues with their esteemed food guests. Snacky Tunes is routinely radio perfection for the music or food enthusiast. Again, that's every Monday at 2 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
All right, we are back for our second segment on Cutting the Curd. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby. Our show today has been sponsored by 360 Cookware. Check out more about their products at their website, 360cookware.com. And my guest today is Michael Anderson, who is a cave manager slash affineur and is an expert on aging cheeses. So, we talked a little bit about your experience working in the caves at Murray's Cheese, and they're certainly influencing, sort of the cheese industry, bringing in cheeses, making sure that they're cared for correctly before they're sent out to the end consumer. But there are a couple of other people doing this work more at the farm level, specifically the sellers at Jasper Hill and Willie Lehner, who has Bluemont Dairy in Madison or outside of Madison, Wisconsin. So, Mike, you've been up to the sellers at Jasper Hill. What do you think about, their affinage techniques and what's going on up there?
Yeah, well, they've got like a very ambitious project that I know a lot of us are familiar with, but it's, 20,000 some square feet of cave space on their farm property, which is huge. It's a really big undertaking, but it's kind of based on a French model of like consolidated affinage. They're trying to remove some of the workload from farmstead cheesemakers in terms of, aging product, holding on to all that inventory, and then marketing and distributing it. So it really just makes sense from that standpoint to consolidate all of that stuff. And then they've got national distribution at this point, seeing Vermont farmstead cheese all across the country, from New York to Chicago to San Francisco. It's kind of incredible that they've been able to do that. And the idea is, as far as I understand it, is to not only take the workload off of the farmstead cheesemakers, but have a dialogue back and forth with them to, improve the products and, kind of working synergistically in that way.
Yeah.
Really interesting.
Absolutely. And they, they're aging a bunch of different kinds of cheeses. Mm. So, can you tell us a little bit about how the caves are set up and,
Well, the big one, kind of the showstopper is the Cabot Cave. It's, something like, 50-foot ceilings. It's really massive. But the entire thing is just full of Cabot cloth bound cheddar. You start at one end of the room. It's the stuff they've just received and wrapped, recently. And then you go all the way around to the extra age. They've got, up to, 18 months, sometimes some extra age cheese, just one massive room full of one kind of cheese, is kind of stunning to see.
And what's it like in there? What does it smell like? What is it?
Well, if you ever smelled the rind of a cloth bound cheddar, has like a very kind of musty, basementy, celery type aroma to it. And if you just imagine that kind of intensified by 100 times, it's almost overpowering, but really neat to see.
And what kind of work do they do in there to ensure that those cheddars are sort of moving along the way that they want them to?
Well, a few things. They're testing them all the time, tasting them all the time, making sure that the flavors are developing the way that they should be. And that's kind of a unique skill that a true affineur needs to have too, is knowing what a young cheese should taste like before it's ready to go, and to make sure. And they're selecting batches that they're going to be selling young, and they're selecting batches they're going to be selling extra aged. So knowing what like a green cheese tastes like before it's ripened is a pretty specialized kind of tasting skill that mm-hmm. you need to have.
Mm-hmm.
So they're plugging those wheels, taking samples of those pretty regularly, and basically flipping the cheeses over and Brushing the mite dust off of them is a big one too.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about cheese mites for a second.
Sure,
I mean, that's a thing that a beast that an affineur has to contend with that most people don't.
Yeah. And there's no beating around the bush. They're teeny tiny bugs that eat away at the rinds of cheeses. And they're totally expected for, you know, a number of different styles of cheese. Kind of Mimolette is one of the big examples of that. Cheese from Flanders looks like a little cannonball. like a pockmarked rind that's just been eaten away at by all these teeny tiny cheese mites.
Look like little asteroids or something.
Yeah, right.
Fallen to Earth.
Exactly. But that's, you know, totally expected for a cheese like that. And cloth-bound cheeses are the other kind of big culprit for the cheese mites. What they do is they're just supposed to kind of work at the surface of the cheese, and in combination with all the dried cheese that's on the surface and any molds that grow during the aging process, creates like a protective layer on the outside so the cheese can age for months and years. They shouldn't really affect the flavor of the cheese at all. They shouldn't get into the cheese itself, but they will definitely have an aroma. That mites have a very distinctive aroma, and different mites kind of smell differently, so it's going to affect the way you taste the cheese, but you're not eating bugs or anything. I don't want to give that impression, but you're gonna smell it, and it's almost like it, in some cases it's like a potpourri or like a lavendery sort of aroma, which is really interesting.
So weird. Yeah, I've encountered that, and it's just like it's a bizarre aroma that you would never associate with with tiny microscopic things.
Yeah, but they're I guess the French call them petites affineurs, little affineurs.
The ones you don't have to pay. No.
Exactly. They're happy. We're happy.
Absolutely. All right. So mites on, you know, sort of aged cheeses. And then I know at Jasper Hill, they also have a cave that's dedicated to wash rind cheeses.
Yeah, definitely.
Can you talk to us about, I don't know, how that care differs from the care of aged cheeses?
Yeah. Well, a wash rind is another example of a surface ripened cheese. You've got something growing on the outside, but it's actively transforming the cheese from the outside in. In the case of wash rinds, it's a bacterial culture. And to encourage that, the cultures are added to the rind, but they're also continually washed in brine or some sort of liquid to keep it moist and to keep the bacteria happy and growing. That's a much more labor-intensive, well, I don't know, much more labor-intensive, but equally labor-intensive proposition is washing all of those cheeses a couple of times a week, flipping them over, keeping those rinds developing.
Yeah. And if you don't wash them, what starts to happen?
Well, if you don't wash them, a few things will happen. First of all, they'll dry out and the rinds will harden and darken and turn into kind of a different thing. Because if you think of something like Gruyere, the rind on a Gruyere has been washed, but also been allowed to harden, because that's just serving to protect the cheese. It's not ripening the cheese or anything. But a washed rind, something like a Taleggio or like Meadow Creek Grayson, is washed. You want to keep that rind like bright orange and vibrant and ripening the cheese from the outside in.
Absolutely. And so Jasper Hill, they do the cheddar, they do the wash rinds. They have other cheeses in the caves as well. How are those cheeses cared for?
Well, there are things like the bloomy rinds, which are trying, again, surface ripened cheese, but you're growing mold on the outside of that. But you want to control that so it doesn't turn into like some kind of thick and chewy layer of mold on the outside. You're trying to develop a nice, tight rind that's adhering to the surface of the cheese, but also releasing its enzymes and ripening the cheese and softening the cheese over time.
I think, we've all had that experience where you eat a cheese that's like, a leathery kind of thick rind.
Yeah, it's just
and
like
then,
chewy and unpleasant. And that's really not what you're looking for. You just want like a really delicate, thin, papery rind on the outside. And achieving that is hard. You got to pat the molds down and flip those cheeses over on a pretty regular basis.
Okay. Yeah, I always think, it's almost like being a gardener or something. You know, you just kind of have to go out every day. And
it is, you got to take a look at, you know, how things are developing and what you need to do to make sure they're going the right way.
Yeah. And so what about Willie Lehner? What's going on with his cheese caves over in Wisconsin?
He's working in kind of more of a Swiss model. Like, he doesn't have his own animals. He doesn't have his own cheese-making equipment. What he does have is a cave that he built on his property, which is pretty incredible. But he uses milk and he uses cheese making facilities of other cheesemakers in southern Wisconsin, of which there are plenty.
Mm-hmm.
But then he makes the cheese and brings it back to his cave and ages it there.
So he actually makes it all offsite.
He makes it all, yeah, offsite.
From different, many different facilities.
Many different facilities, many different milks, which takes a lot of skill, obviously, to be able to deal with something that's even that variable. But then aging them all himself. He's more like a cheese mercenary, like going out there and just making these fantastic cheeses,
killing them left and right, taking this milk, just turn it into good cheese.
Exactly. But yeah, that's a really interesting thing that he's got there. I don't know anyone else who's doing what he is.
Yeah, that's amazing. He's like a roving. He's like a Johnny Appleseed of cheese from his little area.
Yeah, and I was at ACS last year and just seeing the amount of cheeses that he had entered in the competition was pretty incredible too. And they're all fantastic.
What are the ranges? What does he do? What are
Well, he does a little cloth bound cheddar, which is super fantastic. He does washed rinds. He does like Alpine style cheeses.
Okay.
So kind of runs the gamut.
Wow.
Mostly harder, slightly longer aged cheeses.
That's I think I remember him telling me once that he was of Swiss, or his family was Swiss. And so he has kind of this deep history of with dairy and stuff like that. So he's kind of hardwired to make at least, that style of cheese, but to expand to many different styles is pretty impressive.
Yeah, definitely. And one thing I've always thought is interesting is that, it's Blue Mont Dairy in Blue Mounds, Wisconsin.
Okay.
So it's a Swiss guy with a French name making English style cheeses in Wisconsin. It's one of those only in America.
Yeah, perfect American immigrant story.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
Absolutely. And so how about anybody else? Is there anybody else who's doing really groundbreaking affinage work in the United States, be it a cheesemaker or an independent affineur?
In the States, those are the big ones I can think of. I mean, every cheesemaker is aging their cheese, basically. You have to for it to be what it is. But
and do you anticipate? I mean, because in Europe, like you said, this is pretty. It's much more commonplace. It's a more well developed industry. Can you see there becoming a sort of profitable business opportunity for people who want to get into the game of aging cheese?
Yeah, I think there absolutely could be, and Jasper Hill is definitely the model for that. And seeing how that develops over the next 5-10 years is going to be really interesting for all of us. But definitely, and if you were to say the same thing about French affinage, I mean, affinage is obviously a French word, so they've got a little bit more of a history of that, and there's half a dozen French affineurs that are exporting cheese to the United States, and, innumerable more over there. Like, almost every cheese shop has their own affinage program to some extent over there. So, 20 years from now, who knows in the States what it's going to look like. But right now, it's kind of a small list of people who are, aging cheese in that sort of way.
Yeah. Yeah. And for yourself, what do you think about, I mean, you were a music person before you got into cheese. Do you see yourself, what are the harmonies there? No pun intended. Are you interested in more of the actual sciencey, microbiology part? Or is it more of an artistic practice that you think,
It's I kind of come at it with a very analytic and scientific mindset, which is strange because there's a lot of things that we're still trying to figure out. And when it comes to the actual work, it's much more visceral and hands-on and, I guess, artistic, you would say. But there's all these microbes, there's all these molds and yeast and bacteria with their pH tolerances and salt tolerances and water activity, all these things, all these very sciencey things. But it's really only the last 50, maybe 100 years that anyone's known anything at all about that. And then for the centuries of cheesemaking leading up to that, it's all been, kind of oral tradition handed down. Like, this is what this cave should smell like. This is what this cheese should look like.
It's based on intuition.
Yeah,
and
much
and
more
experience.
Intuitive, much more visceral, much less analytical.
And it's interesting because music to me is totally a combination of those two things as well.
Yeah, it absolutely is. Yeah, there's a lot of technical knowledge that needs to go into it, but if there's no soul behind it, then it's not going to be anything anyone wants to listen to. Or anyone wants to eat in the case of cheese.
Yeah, absolutely. The cheese has to be tuned to the harmony of the cosmos.
Yeah, I guess.
that was getting a little bit out there, but but we can dork out about stuff like that. We're cheese people.
That's why we do it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show today and share your experience of affinage and expertise in ripening cheeses.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me.
And we will see you next Sunday on another episode of Cutting the Curd.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.